So, yeah, good morning, everyone. Morning, everyone at home as well. Before I start, I want to thank Simon for choosing the songs we've sung this morning. I know I chose one of them that we're singing at the end, but really, I don't need to preach a sermon this morning because the songs we've sung have actually told exactly the story. But I'm going to make you suffer with a sermon anyway. Let me just get this adjusted nicely. During the lockdown, Liz and I, along with I know many others, have been binge watching series on television. We have probably seen pretty well everything that Walter Presents has ever presented. We've seen dramas from Netherlands, Poland, Germany, France. Well, lots of places. And they all have something in common, as do most series that you ever see. Every episode will finish with a cliffhanger that leaves you asking a question. Usually with the hero in some desperate position that you can't possibly believe they can ever get out of. But then the next episode opens with some miraculous revelation whereby they're spared until the next cliffhanger at the end of this episode. And also lately what we've noticed is that the producers have introduced a feature called the flashback in order to give you the backstory of what's going on and why we find ourselves in the situation in the series. So every episode has the horrendous ending, the cliffhanger, and the backstory being built in as well. And our Bible passage for this morning is no exception to that. It is full of cliffhangers and flashbacks in order to enrich the story. And our reading is in Genesis chapter 22, verses 1 to 18. If you want to follow it in the Pew Bibles, it's right at the very beginning on page 22. Okay, episode 1. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. Then God said, "Take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah, sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain that I will show you." End of episode 1. Is Abraham really going to do what God is asking him to do, to sacrifice his only son? Well, episode 2. Early the next morning, Norman, I certainly feel a bit loud because my ears are ringing. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he'd cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servant, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We'll worship him and then we will come back to you." Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, "Father." "Yes, my son," Abraham replied. "The fire and the wood are here," Isaac said, "but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham answered, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And the two of them went on together. Here we've got a flashback. And in order to understand what's going on here, we need to go back to the story of Isaac. And to do that, let's go back to Genesis chapter 18. Sorry, I haven't got a page for you, but it's just a couple of pages before where you are now. This is the story of the three men who appeared to Abraham. And I'm not going to say what it was, but Abraham looked after them. In fact, he asked his servants to prepare 16 kilograms of flour and a fatted calf. These were obviously very hungry people. But the key to the story is that the three men asked Abraham where his wife Sarah was. In the tent, he says. One of them says, "I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, will have a son." Now Sarah, who was well past the age of childbearing at this stage, heard that in the tent and laughed. Laughed a cynical laugh. "How on earth is this going to happen? Ha ha ha." But the men insisted, "This will happen, because for God, nothing is impossible." And then we read on a little bit more in Genesis chapter 21 about the birth of Isaac. And it happened exactly as those men had prophesied. And Sarah then laughed with joy. And in fact, Abraham, in giving the name of Isaac to his son, reinforced the whole idea of laughter and joyfulness. The name Isaac in Hebrew itself means he who laughs, he who has joy in his heart. And so Sarah's cynicism is turned to joy. And what Abraham is now being asked to do is to take that joy that's come into their lives and to sacrifice it. And Isaac, who sees the wood for the burnt offering, who sees the knife and doesn't see anything that could be sacrificed other than perhaps himself, and yet in trust, he goes forward with his father Abraham. As we read, they went forward together. So flashback gives us a picture of what was really going on in this circumstance and what was really happening in terms of what Abraham was being asked to do. So reading on, when they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. End of episode 2. Is this really going to happen? Is Abraham really going to make this supreme sacrifice? Fortunately, there's an episode 3. The angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. "Do not lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." Abraham looked up, and there in a thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. And Abraham called that place, "The Lord will provide." In Hebrew, Jehovah Jireh, "The Lord will provide." And to this day it's said, "On the mountain of the Lord it will be provided." The angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, "I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies. And through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed because you obeyed me. So today's passage gives us the theme for what we're talking about this morning. Jehovah Jireh, God provides. But the word Jireh doesn't in Hebrew mean that God provides. It has a deeper meaning. It means God sees, God perceives and provides. So it's not just a ego. It is God sees to it. God sees what's going on, perceives the need and provides. Abraham was prepared to give his only son, but God provided an alternative sacrifice. So what do we learn from this story? What does it tell us about our lives today? Well, first of all, God tested Abraham. Now, it's theologically, I'm told, incorrect to say that God tests us. But God has given us a free will whereby we can make choices in our life, in any circumstance. And that is a test, in a way, of the choice that we make when we're faced with a decision about the way our life is going to go. Abraham demonstrated immediate obedience. He didn't question, he didn't murmur. The very next morning, he got everything prepared and set out. No question. And this was not a minimal sacrifice that Abraham was making, as we've seen. It was his only son that had brought so much joy to their life, he and Sarah. The thing is, though, Abraham was not blindly following orders. Now, we know this because later in the Bible, in Hebrews, we're told by faith Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had embraced the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, "It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." In other words, Isaac would be the spring of all of the civilization to follow. Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead, and so, in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from the dead in God's provision of the alternative sacrifice. Because of Abraham's faith and trust, God provided. Now, the sort of series that Liz and I have been watching so far might easily just leave the story there. Yeah, we have a lesson. We make choices in life. We should make our choices in obedience to God's will and God's purpose. And if we do that, we should trust that God will provide. And okay, you could leave it there. But this story is more than just a story about Abraham's sacrifice. This story is actually a prophecy. This story is a prophecy of Christ's coming. It's a prophecy of Christ's birth and life and death and resurrection. And there are enormous parallels between the story of Abraham and Isaac and the story of Christ and his death and resurrection. I mean, I'm not going to go into the detail, but I can say that if you're interested, that wonderful man, Charles Haddon Spurgeon, actually wrote a little paper where he defines all of the parallels. And he calls it the Gospel of Abraham's Sacrifice of Isaac. If you're interested, I've got a copy that you can have a look at. But thinking, just in summary about those parallels, the sacrifice of an only son. Isaac carries the wood on his back. Jesus carries the cross on his back. Isaac is spared by the sacrifice of a ram. And the parallel breaks down a little bit because Jesus was not spared. God did not spare Jesus the same as he allowed Abraham to spare Isaac. Jesus actually went through the suffering of death and isolation and separation from his father. But the glorious thing is that through that sacrifice, he rose again. And by being resurrected, God broke the chains of sin and opened the life gate for us to be in a relationship with him. He became a personal God to each one of us as individuals. Now, how do we know that this is a prophecy? Well, actually, Jesus himself tells us in the Gospel of John, in chapter 8. Jesus himself told the Jews, "Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day. He saw it and he was glad." So we read now in the Gospel of John how God's only son was sacrificed for us. And you know those words off heart. And so do I. But I could never remember them very well, so I'm going to try and find where I can read them to you. Jesus said, "No one has ever gone into heaven except the one who came from heaven, the Son of Man. Just as Moses lifted up the snake in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that everyone who believes may have eternal life in him." And you all know the next words. "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him." Okay, so once again, we can learn a lesson from this. The fact that God provided a sacrifice that allowed us to come into a personal relationship with him. And we can believe that in doing so, we can write three things that we're really thankful for that we've had in our lives. And why not? Because God, I mean, for most of us here, maybe for all of us here, God has provided a lot. So it'd be very easy for a preacher to leave the story there and say, yeah, okay, God's made the sacrifice. You believe, you be obedient, and everything will work out wonderfully for you. But we know that the harsh reality of this world is not that schmaltzy, rosy picture at all. We only have to watch the news over the past few days to understand that the real world isn't rosy at all. In trying to prepare this sermon, I have really struggled. I really have, and I'm still struggling. And I've got some words written down here that I had planned to say. I don't know whether I will say them, but I have lived a very privileged life, like so many people here. God has never given me what I wanted. Now, I hope that shocks you, but it shouldn't, because God is not in position of giving us what we want. God has never given me what I want, but he's always given me what I needed. And what I've needed have been some wonderful things that God's given me, like a wonderful wife who's kept me on the straight and narrow. That's God's agent here on earth. Two super kids and four even more super grandsons. And I've enjoyed good health all of my life. I have never been destitute, never been on the breadline. I've never been super rich either. That's what I wanted, but I didn't get it. But I've never been destitute. So it's very easy for me to write three things down here. But that's not the situation for so many people in the world. The question I need to get an answer for, the question is, what on earth is going on when it looks like God's not providing? Okay? And that's happening so often, so much in the world. What is going on when it looks as though God is not providing? Now, I have been a management consultant for over 30 years. I'm just about to retire, by the way, but in those years, one thing I have learned when I'm dealing with questions that can't be answered is that in most cases, it's because we're asking the wrong question. And I believe that if we are asking the question, what is going on when it looks like God isn't providing? That's the wrong question. The question we need to ask is, what is God's provision in this circumstance? How do I understand what is God's plan and purpose here? How is that going to work? And how can I experience it? How can I experience that provision? What is it that God has to provide for me? That's the question that we need to be asking. I have to ask a question at this point. Would somebody be kind enough to get me a glass of water, because I'm running out of voice. And I can assure you it's not emotion at this stage. I might get emotional later on, but right now my throat is very dry. So, we'll take a break for a minute. So, yeah, the question is not what's going on when we don't think God's providing. The question is, how do we understand God's provision? How do we understand his plan? And then how do we put ourselves in the situation of acceptance, of obedience, and finding how we benefit from the provision in a circumstance? Thank you, Tim. You're an angel. Tim has provided. Oh, that's better. Okay. Right. Still got time. I don't have an answer, and I don't think I ever will have an answer this side of heaven. When that happens, whenever it might be, I'm assured that I will get the answer. But in the meantime, in trying to understand the answer to these questions, I have to remember that God is timeless. Our God is an ageless God. God was there before time began. God is now in the present. And God will be beyond the end of time. I mean, God is forever. Was there before the beginning, will be there after the end. And I think we need to look at God's provision in that timeless, ageless way as well. Because before time began, God was making provision in terms of the master plan that God had for his creation. God already had this divine plan for how the universe would be created and develop, of how our little tiny third rock from a star in a galaxy on the very end, on the very edge of a galaxy, on the very edge of the universe, God had a plan for that little third rock from the sun and all the people on it and the nature that it would provide. God made that plan before time began. And there are two things I think we need to understand about God's plan. The plan for nature, in order to give us the world that we live in order to be able for us to live, in order for us to be able to enjoy the wonders of the nature around us, God's plan had some element of organized chaos about it. We would not have the grandeur of mountains. We would not have the pleasant waters of rivers. We would not have the rain to make crops grow. We'd not have the regular periods of throughout the year of death, rebirth, growth. Without that organized chaos in nature, we would not have the world we live in. And that organized chaos does create, from time to time, because it goes on, natural disasters. Volcanoes, tsunamis, floods, droughts. That, we like it or not, is part of how God had planned for creation to develop. In creating mankind, God created man in his own image. I'm trying not to be sexist here. So God created mankind and womankind in his own image. What does that mean? That actually means that we have been given free will. If we'd not been created in God's image, we would have been created as mechanical robots who just did what God told us to do. God didn't want that. He wanted us to be in God's image. And that meant that we have free will. We can make choices which are good or bad. We can make choices which follow God's plan and God's will, or choices that don't. That means then that we have to be prepared, no matter how joyful and fulfilled our life has been, to recognize that that is not the truth for everybody in the world. It's not the truth for the woman whose partner habitually, mentally and physically abuses her. It's not the truth for the millions of people who are left bereaved and homeless by natural disasters. It's not the truth for those 40 million citizens of Ukraine whose sovereign land is now being invaded through the will of one man and the spineless people who he's surrounded himself with. That is the reality of God's initial provision in creating mankind in his image. The good side is that if we take our will and bind it to God's will, great things happen and his plan is fulfilled. If, on the other hand, we disobey God's will and we make choices contrary to his plan and his will, bad things happen, like what's happening in Ukraine at the moment. So God's provision at the beginning of time leads us to the situation we see in the world today. But that does not mean that we have to be fatalistic and just accept that that is it. And nothing can be done, because God was not just there at the beginning of time. God is here now, present. And I want to go back to Paul's sermon of 2 weeks ago, when God through Paul talked about God as the healer, Jehovah Rapha. And what Paul told us was, God actually heals in three different ways: through recovery, through cure, and through supernatural intervention. I was listening, Paul. And, you know, although we can put that in the context of health, actually it works in the context of life. God is present now and allows recovery to happen. There have been awful things happening in the world in the past, exactly the same as what's happening in Ukraine now. We have recovered from them. Yeah, in some cases they are still a memory that's hurtful, but over generations, they disappear in people's minds, and people see how, in fact, quite a lot of good things have come out of those evil times. Okay, so God does, even now, in our society, in the world, provide the possibility of recovery. God provides the possibility of cure. And when you think how we have developed over the years, we're not perfect by any means, but when you look back to how we dealt with each other in history throughout the world, and how now in the civilized part of the world, we've learned a lot of things about the need to get on together, about the need for forbearance, about the need for understanding each other. We've been given the blessing of technology that allows communication so that we can get to know and understand what's going on in other civilizations, in other cultures, and so on. So God does provide the possibility of recovery and cure. And God also provides the possibility of supernatural intervention. And that, I suggest, is what we now need to be praying for in the situation in Ukraine and in so many other areas as well. There is obviously a need for God to intervene in what's going on at the moment. But there is also the need for God to intervene through the work of humans in making it happen. We look at Putin in Russia at the moment, maybe as the personification of evil. And we look at Zelensky in Ukraine as the personification of everything good. And okay, fine, in simple terms, yes. But what is driving Putin to do what he's doing now? We need some understanding of that. And whoever's going to negotiate to end this awful war needs to know what it is that's driving Putin, because that's the only way that any negotiation will actually be successful. So we need to pray for that understanding. We need to pray for the supernatural intervention that negotiation will happen quickly and will end hostility, and will lead to Ukraine becoming once again a sovereign nation. And that may have ramifications that are contrary to what President Biden might like, or Prime Minister Johnson might like, or even what President Zelensky might want. But that is the supernatural intervention we need to pray for now. Okay, that's enough of that. What I see as the real message that we've got this morning is actually not about God's provision before the world began, God's provision now for us, but God's provision for us for the future. And part of the story of history is the preparation for that future. In the prophecy of Abraham pointing to the birth and the death and the resurrection of Christ, we see a glimpse of God's plan for us for the future. We see that no matter what our current circumstances in, and God will provide somehow or other for us, in the future, whether we go to meet God first, or whether we're still there when Christ comes again, there is going to be a dramatic, a radical, a completely changing scene for the future. And we read about it in Revelation chapter 21. And if you want to follow, it's right at the end of the Bible, on page 1249. A new heaven and a new earth. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." He who was seated on the throne said, "I'm making everything new." Then he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." I repeat, these words are trustworthy and true. He said to me, "It's done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all this. I will be their God, and they will be my children." And that is what God provided for us in the sacrifice of his only Son, and what he will provide for us, no matter what our circumstances are now, for the future. That is the hope that we have. So, what do we know? What have we learnt this morning? We've learnt that God sees, God understands, God experiences, and God provides. Through Jesus' life on earth, God actually became human and experienced life as a human. So when God provides, it's not just a provision as a remote Santa Claus, if you like. It's a provision based on experience, a personal experience of what's going on. But what is demanded of us is the faith and the hope which creates the trust in God to provide. I see faith as an understanding of God's purpose, an acceptance of God's purpose, and allowing ourselves to be subject to his purpose. But having the conversation with God that allows us to learn, allows us to ask the question, allows us to ask for the supernatural intervention, but in the context of understanding what is the purpose behind what God is doing. When I first became a Christian, I was given a text, Proverbs chapter 3, verse 5, and again, pretty popular saying. And believe it or not, on the 20th of November in 1989, my wife gave me a study Bible which had that text in the front of it. Now, use that study Bible anymore. Liz has got it and she uses it because I do everything online, as you do. But that text is, to me, the summation of if we are real about understanding and obeying God. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways submit to him and he will direct your paths. That, to me, is the commandment we are personally given. And the hope we have is built through the trust we have through our faith. God requires us to make sacrifices. Yeah? God requires us to sacrifice our selfish wants to his will. God requires our obedience to his purpose. God requires us to have faith and hope and trust, and through that to have love. Because love is the way we express to other people our faith and our hope. When we come to sing our final song, there are some words in the bridge. The bridge, for those of you that are not musicians, that funny bit we sing towards the end of the song that has a totally different tune, and we usually sing it 3 or 4 times. So you get to learn the tune, and then you go back to the chorus, by which time you've forgotten the tune of that. In the bridge for this song, we sing, your goodness is running after, it's running after me. Your goodness is running after me. With my life laid down, I'm surrendered now. I give you everything. Now, when you sing those words, you need to be saying a prayer that you can actually live up to it. Thank you, David. Those words are a prayer. And they're not a prayer about the simple things like giving money and time and possessions. It's much deeper than that. You know, when we sing, with my life laid down, I'm surrendered now, I give you everything. What we're singing is, I give you, God, my trust. I give you my faith. I give you my hope for the future. If you feel you can sing those words, sing them as loud as you possibly can. You might need to get to the third repeat so you know what the tune is, but sing them. Because that is what God asks of us. Yeah? I've said enough. I'm going to hand over to Simon. And we're going to sing about the goodness of God. For some of you, you can sing about the goodness of God knowing that God's always been good to you. For some of you, that might not be the case. Even if you're suffering hardship at the moment and those words are difficult, sing them in hope and in trust.